Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is a Mr. Media interview, sponsored by the audiobook edition of Will Eisner, A Spirited Life, now available on iTunes and Audible.com, and recorded live on BlogTalkRadio.com from the new media and American League Baseball capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I was a little nervous when I received an email from Jane Friedman, the publisher of Writer's Digest Books and Magazine, a few weeks ago. She was responding to my interview with one of her authors, Mike Sachs, who wrote, and here's the kicker, Conversations with 21 Top Humor Writers on Their Craft. Let me say again, it's a great book. If you're interested in writing or humor or TV or movies, it's a really fun, great read. I have it in front of me. I am nearing the end of it. I'm absorbing and enjoying every bit of it. So now I've said that. Now, Sachs was on the show, and he was a little unhappy with a number of the things about the way Writer's Digest Books had published his book, and he wasn't shy about discussing it. And I thought Friedman was going to give me an earful about what a sack Sachs was and how neither of us understood anything about publishing decisions. And much to both of our surprise, because I shared this with Mike, Jane actually agreed with a number of the things that we discussed and was interested in continuing the conversation. I was only too happy to do this. This show, after all, has hosted conversations with the editors and publishers of Smithsonian Magazine, Playboy, Success, Cooking Light, and many others. And as a guy who makes his living writing books and magazine articles, I certainly have an interest in the topic and talking to Jane. As for Jane Friedman, she is publisher and editorial director of the Writer's Digest community at F&W Media in Cincinnati, Ohio, which is where she oversees all the facets of the Writer's Digest brand, including, of course, the Writer's Digest magazine, Writer's Digest books, market guides, online education, events, competitions, when they have a pig roast, that probably comes under her, too. And her blog, There Are No Rules, discusses how writers can succeed in an era of change in the writing and publishing industry. You can read it at http://blog.writersdigest.com/no-rules. And Jane, let's see if we're bringing you on here, see if the button will work. Welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on.
How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Now, tell us the truth. You didn't really agree with what Sachs said. You just needed a polite way to get on the show and shoot arrows at me.
Well, it did open up a marvelous opportunity for me to talk about Writer's Digest, I have to say. So I'm very happy the interview occurred.
Okay.
And, unhappy authors or frustrated authors, it's not something where anybody in the publishing industry is a stranger to. So, some of the things that he said, there are different perspectives on what happened, but, we always want to make our authors happy whenever we can. And sometimes the concerns of the business trump the concerns of the author. So I think some of the things that happened, it really just came down to a business decision. So.
And, a couple of things that I think Mike talked about was that the book was not available. His book is not available electronically. Let me ask you about that. Has Writer's Digest Books not made that jump yet, or was it just Mike? I honestly, I don't know the answer to that question.
Sure. No, there are a number of our books that are available digitally, both on the Kindle and directly from our online store, which is Writer's Digest Shop. So his book isn't yet available, but it's not because it's not part of the program. It is, I think most book publishers would agree with me in saying that this transition is a very difficult one in incorporating into the production process steps that would make the book automatically ready to go onto the Kindle or onto other readers. And actually for the Amazon Kindle, you actually have to pay a fee to have a book on there until it has hit a certain threshold of sales. So typically with new releases, we wait until it hits that number, being the you know, economical people that we are, and then we put it on so that we don't have to pay that added charge.
Oh, I see. So it has to sell a certain number of copies.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I see. And I think something else that Mike was upset about was, and this I think I completely understand, but I'm going to bring it up anyway,
sure.
Was that four of the interviews that he had for the book were cut and were not included, and I guess we're not even being considered for if there was an electronic edition, and
sure.
He wound up having to put those up on his website. That was something else I think that concerned him.
Right, right. Yeah, I'm familiar with that conversation we had about that because it was something that was ongoing. We knew from the beginning we would have too much material. We could only put so many pages in the book before it became a real reference size book. So, and we even discussed having the extra interviews as exclusive material, both on the Writer's Digest site and wherever he would like to post it, whether it was on his site or other people's sites. So you'll find some of that content on our own site. And once we have a Kindle edition in place, obviously we're going to be looking at, can we make this Kindle edition the exclusive edition that has all of the interviews? So certainly these are things we've thought about, and we'd like to do them.
This is a conversation I have with some of the editors and publishers I work with as a writer, not, you know, this outside of the Mr. Media Show, where I say to them, especially in the last year or two, where you'll do a certain amount of work planning on a story being 2,000 or 3,000 or 5,000 words, mm-hmm. and then they come back to you, and the reality today is, well, that story that would have been 3,000 or 5,000 words 2 years ago or even 6 months ago, it may now be 1,500 words or 1,200. And what I find puzzling, and I guess it's there's a couple reasons for this, is that they come back and I say, well, why don't you just post it as bonus content on the web and drive people to your website? And they, the people that I've dealt with, they're like, well, we don't see the value in that. And, you know, people don't go to the website. And no one, you know. What's the logic there, if you don't mind me asking you?
Well, I think a lot of people's mentality still is, you know, protect all of the content and it's kind of the old school way of doing things in one sense, I see the logic of that. If you're producing a print product like a magazine and you want to make sure that that magazine is the full experience, the full print experience, or the book should be a full and a complete experience, and you don't want people to feel like they're missing out on something because it's now online. So I'm not averse to making sure that the print product is complete and that we're not forcing people to go elsewhere to have the complete experience. But I do agree with you that when you have this extra content, or you could call it bonus or, you know, exclusives, you know, you put it up on the site for people who want more, and whether that's, you know, the print content itself or something that's more multimedia like video or audio, whatever the case might be. So with a lot of our books, we actually do online exclusive content. And with the magazine, we always have, you know, a full-page TOC listing all of the ways that you can get more information that we couldn't fit into print, mm-hmm. you know, going to the website for that. So I think there's going to be hopefully more of this kind of activity across all types of publishing. And I think it's happening already. But I think the real nut to crack is when you're looking at a brand or a title, what does it mean for that content to be in print versus online, and where do those experiences meet, and how do the audiences differ? Because our audience of our print content, whether it's a magazine or a book, that's not the same audience that's on our sites. There's some overlap, but it's not a complete overlap, and we have to recognize which audiences we're serving with each product.
Hmm. And I find that the newspapers are starting, and they're so slow on this because they're they're so monolithic and they've been at it for so long, and of course they know best. But, you know, if I'm doing a story, and maybe it's because I also do this radio show, and I think in these terms, if I'm doing a cover story for somebody, I usually will use a tape recorder and we'll do the interview. What I do now is I make sure that I start the interview by saying, you know, this is Bob Andelman for XYZ Magazine. Mm-hmm. I'm here today with so-and-so, and then I record it as an interview. I try to keep it professional,
right?
And then at the end, I, you know, say, well, thank you very much for being with us on, you know, on the show for whatever. And then I, you know, transcribe the tape or have it transcribed, and then I present to the magazine whether they ask for it or not. they have the article that they paid for, but they also have the option of using an audio.
Right.
And very few of them have the understanding or the interest in that, which is interesting because on the one hand, they're trying to figure out how to drive traffic to their website, but on the other hand, it's like mixing church and state.
Well, we would love to have you freelance for us and provide us audio because that's exactly what we hope. Those are the types of freelancers and authors we love to work with who are thinking the same way that you do and that there are a lot of different ways that people can consume content. And it's just yet another way to present a story or information.
Well, now you're crossing the line here, Jane, because I think that's called a conflict of interest. I'm trying to interview you and be professional, and now you're saying, well, we'd really like to have you write for us. Well, that's okay, yeah. That's true. In the interest of full disclosure, I have written a story for at least one for Writer's Digest, but it was back in another century, and I don't think any of the people who assigned, edited, or published it are probably even still alive. It was so long ago. Let's broaden the talk. Oh, well, actually, let's stick with Mike for just one more minute. And I did give Mike the opportunity to call in if he wanted to, and I'll keep an eye out if he does. I don't think he wanted to engage this directly. I guess you guys have had the conversation enough. But one of the other things with Mike is that in his book, which I love this book, I can't say it enough. I really love this book, and I recommended it. And my wife is now reading it behind me on this. It's just a fun book. His interviews, I gather, were tape recorded, and I would think would make great content and for driving people to the book as well. Is there audio from his book on the Writer's Digest site?
Well, that's a great question. We don't have any audio from him. I should say, yeah. I didn't personally edit the book, so I wasn't in on any conversations where if he mentioned having the audio or wanting to share it. But certainly, it's something we would consider.
Just a thought. It's funny, I don't think you'd be aware of this, but within an hour of finishing the interview with Mike, I heard from a publicist who represents a guy named Hank Rosenfeld, who wrote a book called The Wicked Wit of the West, and it's sort of the autobiography of a guy named Irving Brecker, who wrote a number of Marx Brothers films, and he wrote for Milton Berle and so on. And he's interviewed in Mike Sack's book, and here's the kicker. He's one of the 21 comedy writers in there. And so the publicist on that book contacted me and said, hey, you just did this interview with Sacks. Here's another book. And I thought, oh, well, you know. And so they sent me the book. And I'm liking that as much as this. And it's interesting how these things take on a life of their own. And here we are having this conversation.
Exactly.
So, let's talk about the broader market. Writer's Digest, I was a long, long time subscriber to Writer's Digest while I was getting going. I subscribed to Writer's Digest when I was 13.
Wow.
And I started freelancing when I was 13 or 14 years old and got it for many, 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 many years and always recommended it and always got the annual books. I mean, that was my parents for Hanukkah would get me the each year's Writer's Market when I was in high school. That's how involved I was in all this. But I look at it now, and the newspaper and magazine market is, I mean, really seriously drying up. Even the ones that I thought would not dry up in this situation are drying up because they've been caught flat-footed. They don't understand. They don't want to understand how to mix their media, so to speak. Where does this leave an empire like Writer's Digest with the books and the magazines when the general markets that we've known are disappearing?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an excellent question. And you could see the change in our magazine as well in the books that we publish over the past 10 years because I think we've actually felt this effect long before we saw it coming up in the industry as far as newspapers and magazines closing. We noticed that our books and articles on freelance work, newspaper journalism, magazine journalism, those sales were falling off dramatically. But what was selling was anything related to novel writing, finding an agent, anything more creative writing related. And so there's been this huge market open up you know, since the advent of word processing and people having more spare time or thinking that they have a book inside them that needs to come out. And most people aspire to write a novel more so than they aspire to write freelance, at least as far as our market is concerned. And I think it has changed over the past 20 to 30 years. I mean, some of our best-selling books in the 70s were titles like How to Make $25,000 a Year as a Writer. But what we're finding, you know, is obviously people are still interested in making that kind of money, although even that kind of money today actually might be fairly significant considering the economy and the state of freelancing. But most people are wanting an agent, and they want to get that first novel out there. So that's where our market has shifted.
So it's, I mean, I find that all the time. As a matter of fact, I was contacted recently by someone who wants to write a novel and, you know, was looking for a writer. And generally I say no to that, but it was someone who had a more compelling story, so I'm actually looking at it. But so, you know, when it was freelance writers interested in writing magazine and newspaper pieces, there was actually a bigger market there because there were so many small weeklies and regional publications and all that kind of stuff, national trade magazines. That's all drying up. So ironically, at the same time that journalists are out there in greater and greater numbers looking for things to do with their skills.
Right.
So I'm kind of wondering if you're seeing, well, yeah, I understand what you're saying about everybody wants to write a novel and they're looking for help and how to get an agent and that kind of thing. Are you seeing more of the journalists coming to the Writer's Digest publications looking for help as to what to do as a freelancer?
I think we're definitely getting a lot of response from people who want to know, you know, how they're going to adapt if magazines and newspapers aren't giving out assignments, or if a lot of the content that's generated now is expected to come without payment. You know, you find a lot of, especially when you're looking at online writing and content aggregation sites, there's this expectation that you'll provide the content for free and then earn money off of advertising or how many clicks you get, or the other metrics that then lead to some kind of payment, which is usually low. So I think what freelancers really have to do in general is follow the reader. Wherever readers are paying money for content, that's where the jobs are going to be. And so we find that a lot of readers aren't necessarily paying for news anymore, at least on a mass market scale. They might, however, pay for news and articles on a local level. So I think that that's what journalists really need to pay attention to, is who's paying for what content, because that's where the money, that's where they're going to get their paycheck from. And I think,
go ahead, please.
Well, I was going to say, when I talk about the local, at the local level, I'm also talking, if you think about it a little more broadly, many people who talk about the future of publishing say that the future is in niches or in specialties. So if you look at the corporate parent of Writer's Digest, which is F&W Media, we're positioned very well to be successful for a long time to come because we do specialize in very particular interest areas, whether it's writing, design, art, woodworking, collectibles. So it's more about having a lot of media and a lot of content focused on a specific audience rather than, you know, what traditional trade book publishing is, which is you have 30 different books on 30 different topics and 30 different audiences, and that's a huge investment of time and energy when you have to go after each market separately.
Yeah, it is interesting. It's all in one place. Has you know, the Writer's Digest group, though, I mean, have you guys had to make the same kind of cutbacks and adjustments that other publications have in the last year or two?
I think for Writer's Digest, it hasn't been so much a matter of cutting headcount. It has been a matter of cutting expenses and a matter of producing more content with the same amount of people. So I do think as a company, you know, we've been hit just as hard as anyone else, but we have a lot of confidence and enthusiasm that, you know, in the next year or so, we're going to come out stronger than ever. So,
I mean, so you have people making these decisions, I guess, who feel like there is a turning point.
Oh yeah, absolutely. There's a turning point. I mean, I think some of the some of the advertising that has supported some of the publications here, you know, that's never going to return to the level that it was once at. But we're transforming and adapting to that and finding ways to charge people for the content rather than lowering the price on the content and having it subsidized by advertising. So I think you'll see that in a lot of the articles that you see today that get a lot of attention are the publications that are able to get the readers to pay for the value of the content rather than the other way around. So like The Economist and Cook's Illustrated are the two examples that come up really frequently where it's very much subscription-driven rather than advertising-driven.
So, well, you know, I've completely forgot. I wanted to give out our phone number. If anyone's listening and, you know, in the time we have remaining wants to give Jane a call, ask her a question, give us a holler, 1-646-595-3135. Call and talk to Jane Friedman, the publisher and editorial director of the Writer's Digest community of publications. So, you know, are there as many ads for poetry contests as there used to be?
Those have actually fallen off a bit. One of the biggest advertisers that we have to do with the self-publishing industry. Mm. So, you know, all of the places that people have to go, because there's a 99% rejection rate, if they want to see their work in print, they're going to have to pay to see it in physical form.
Is it 96%? Because I want to run that by my wife more often in the future. When I say, honey, you know, I've had X number of books published, and, you know, they do turn down 96% of what they get. So get off my back.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think 96 is actually an optimistic number.
Yeah.
I think it might be 99.
Well, I remember seeing this breakdown years ago where we were talking about writers, and something like 5% of all – I hope I remember this right – 5% of all the writers, all the people who call themselves writers, are making a really good living at it. And then the next 10% are making a living at it, and they're surviving and they're doing okay. And then the other 85% of people that call themselves writers, that may mean that they've sold one thing in their life, or maybe they sold something a year or something. And I always, you know, always try to steel myself with things like that, because it can be tough out there. It can be very, very difficult to do this. So how did you let's change gears a little bit? How did you wind up at Writer's Digest? And I'm curious because I look at I see your picture, and you barely look like you'd be old enough to be out of college, Jen.
Well, thank you.
Is that good gene?
Good gene, absolutely. father's from New York City, so that good genes there. And then my mother's from Indiana. That's where I actually that's where I was before I got my job at Writer's Digest. But yeah, I mean, I've been working for F&W ever since I left college, and that's been about 11 or 12 years now.
Oh my God! So they froze you.
Sorry.
You're in carbonite.
I've been here for a good spell. So most of those with Writer's Digest specifically in some form.
Hmm. Is it an interesting job? I mean, you know, working, I guess, with writers and editorial people.
Can you define interesting?
challenging, topical.
I think the most interesting part of my job is in fact a result of how F&W is now structured, which is in fact a very new thing. Last fall, it's been about a year ago now, the company divided itself into communities rather than book division, magazine division, events division, online division. They decided that those barriers between how we produce the content, whether it was in a book form or magazine form, they decided those were becoming extremely irrelevant. And and also that silo effect, it really ended up having, you know, like Writer's Digest Books was under different leadership than Writer's Digest Magazine. And so sometimes the two entities would even be at cross purposes and not even know what each other was doing. There were a lot of inefficiencies, too, as a result of that system. So last fall, the company did something that was very forward-thinking and I think is going to preserve it, the company, for decades, and that is they decided, look, we don't serve people through books or magazines. We serve people through what they're passionate about. So they eliminated those walls and said, and split up the company into these interest areas, writing being one of the biggest. So now, you know, I entered Writer's Digest as a magazine editor, and then I switched over to the book side. And then eventually I oversee every piece of it. So the most interesting fact, I think, about what I do every day is that it's not limited to any one type of media. It's very much thinking holistically about how we reach a writer rather than how we do a particular book or how we do a particular magazine issue. It's much more integrated.
I'm sorry, I'm still thinking about all the people who either had to die or be pushed out of the way as you made your corporate climb. It sounds like an episode of, you know, like Canon or something. I don't know. I'm just kidding, but I mean, it makes sense. I never understood that. I mean, if I spoke to the editor of Writer's Digest magazine, I would think that he or she would know what the book publishing side was doing, and not just knew, but would be involved, because, well, we know what we're hearing from our readers, and they need books like this. But if it's completely different divisions, you know, you could see how that could cause problems over time.
Exactly. It did cause problems, but I don't think we're in a perfect situation right now, because there's still a lot of you know, back end and administrative things that still need to be smoothed out as a corporation. Things that happen when you eliminate those barriers, there's a lot of things that still have to continue for the whole company that can't necessarily be communitized or segmented in that way. So, but in general, you know, you can see the potential for growth and see how we've grown as a community and have become much more cohesive. And we have one direction rather than four or five different directions, because we also had the online properties and the online workshops. All those were also managed by separate people. So,
yeah, that does seem, you know, in retrospect, you probably look at that and go, well, that was dumb. I can understand it, because I imagine over time, and being you know, probably a little bit, well, I know I'm a little bit older than you. I mean, you could see these things over the years grow. It's like, okay, it's the magazine, and now the magazine is publishing books, and now the magazine is hosting seminars, and probably as each of those developed, someone new was thrown out there. Here, you go deal with the seminars, you go deal
right.
with the books, and then before you know it, you know, it's like an octopus. And
exactly. I think that we've really been able to look at what we do more as content development and content strategy, rather than that we're specifically a magazine editor or a book editor or an online workshop coordinator. It's much more effective when we can approach it from, okay, we have this piece of content. How does it work in print? How does it work on the site? How does it work as a course? It makes a lot more sense, and we're serving writers much better that way.
Hmm. What I don't know if you can address this or not. You mentioned that what most people are coming to this community for is help with, you know, writing fiction and writing novels. Are there other hot points, hot buttons that people who are coming to Writer's Digest are looking for these days, or that they're interested in, or directions that you're heading?
Sure. I think agents has always been a very popular topic. What we're also finding is that for the people who do get published and beat the odds, they're looking at what happens once the book is released, and do they understand what happens before that point and after that point, and how they can effectively partner with their publisher? Because I see a lot of disappointed authors who, you know, they thought that their publisher was going to do more from a marketing perspective, or they were expecting more investment. And then it doesn't come, and they find themselves ill-prepared to deal with that reality. Because as many people know, when there's a very small window of time after the book releases when you can really effectively market and promote it when it's on those store shelves and hasn't not yet been returned. So if the sales don't pick up in those first months, it can really affect a book's future as far as its future on like a chain bookstore shelf.
Oh, the story could tell. Yeah, I mean, I make my living as a co-author, as a credited guy who works with like CEOs and other fairly well-known people who have a book idea but don't, you know, they can't write a book or they don't have the time, and I'll come in and do it. But when I talk to them, I always caution them. I say, now look, you need to go into this with a marketing plan of your own, because even the biggest publisher there's two things. You can measure what their commitment is going to be by how much the advance is. Mm-hmm. If they give you, you know, six-figure advances plus, then they're going to have more of a commitment. If they give you less than that, they may think you're a wonderful guy, but you're going to get about a week's time and interest from them promoting the book. And no one wants to believe that. Even today, with all the stories that can be told, they just refuse to believe it's book publishing, it's glamour, it's this, it's that. Yes, it is. You'll have a book with your name on it, but the week after it comes out, you're on your own, son. Mm-hmm. And people just don't get that. But it's so true.
Yeah.
And it's hard to beat that into people's heads.
It is. They somehow think that they're going to be the exception. So it's a continual process of education to tell people, look, you've got to plan at least 12 months out, and you need an online presence. If you're not online, you're invisible, and you really need to be interacting with whoever your potential audience is. And it might not be Facebook or Twitter that you have to get involved with, but you do have to be somehow involved. And I think a lot of people realize that after it's far too late.
That's it. Once it's done and published, then it's too late. You have to have that plan going in. Writer's Digest Books, I'm presumed, does not have the resources of a Random House with its books. How much can you actually provide the author in terms of marketing and promotion? We've got one in front of us, Mike Sachs, for example.
Right. He has done a phenomenal job on marketing and promoting his book on his own, and we can really take no credit for all of the publicity hits that he's gotten. He's just been amazingly proactive and wonderful in that vein. As far as what we do as a publisher to market, most of our efforts are concentrated on internal marketing lists and our community lists. So, for instance, for Here's the Kicker, we have a full-page ad running in the magazine with information about the book that links to an excerpt that's on our website. It becomes a featured pick on our homepage at writersdigest.com. You know, it's part of email blasts that we do to our lists, which, exceed 100,000 names. And so because we sell the books direct from our bookstore and also have the content on our sites, we're always reaching out to that web of people who take our courses, who are subscribers to writersmarket.com, who were former book club members, because we did used to have a book club. So we have this really amazing reach into this specialized audience, and there is almost no way that they, I would say within 2 months, there's no way they would not know about this book's existence if they are in any way connected to Writer's Digest, whether that's, by visiting our site or subscribing to our newsletter. So I think that's where our power resides.
And speaking of, so there's no more Writer's Digest Book Club. I was a proud member of that for many years. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, well, I think as you've seen with probably all of the club models, they're incredibly challenged, and that's mainly because of Amazon. But we do now have an online shop with kind of a similar club thing that you can join. It's not like the Writer's Digest Book Club where you would actually get a physical mailing with a negative option, meaning you would have to decline that month's selection. We had to stop that just because it's so expensive to do that, considering the return on it.
Oh, yeah, because you're paying for shipping both directions.
Right, exactly. So that was just very, very wasteful, and that model worked 20 years ago, but not today. So now all of our sales, are directly through the Writer's Digest shop, and we have, loyalty programs associated with that. So people can still find out about the books in a very concentrated way through that site.
And Jane, what are some of the more enduring titles over the years? What continues to sell year in and year out? I assume the Writer's Market is probably near the top of the list, but
not. Definitely. That's the number one book. We've been publishing it consistently every year since 1920. Looking at some of the other titles that are not the annuals, How to Write a Book Proposal by Michael Larson has been a longtime bestseller since the early 80s, and he's a literary agent based in San Francisco. We have always done very well with the basic instruction books, like, you can write a novel, you can write children's books, And then we have one of our most popular authors right now is James Scott Bell, who does really excellent fiction technique advice. And also the other one would be Donald Moss, who's a literary agent based in New York. And we just he did a book for us in the 90s called Writing the Breakout Novel. And we just released a new one by him called The Fire in Fiction. And so he and Jim are probably our key fiction authors right now.
And on the magazine side, what what are some of the enduring features over the years, and what has kind of fallen by the wayside? What has disappeared from prominent status, or any status at all, for that matter?
On the magazine?
Yeah.
Yeah. We've always run some type of fiction or nonfiction or poetry columns over the years, and we've tried to consolidate all of that kind of instruction into a workbook section in the back that has a theme.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than have I think the problem with our columns and with has sometimes been there's such a small amount of space to get something valuable across. You know, you only have like maybe 800 to 1,000 words, so the workbook section helps us dedicate, you know, anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 words on one area of fiction writing or nonfiction writing. The features that have always been popular, 101 Websites has been one of our best-selling issues for many years, as well as our agent roundup, where we find agents who are looking for new writers and are open, you know, to someone who has never published a novel or their first nonfiction book. So as far as what's new, I think those do the best, and we tend to avoid anything that's really freelance-based. So we used to have like a freelance basics section,
mm-hmm.
which has gone
mm-hmm.
away. We also used to have a self-publishing column, and that's gone away too. We try to address that in one issue every couple years.
I know I've a lot of people who've come to me over the years wanting to do things where I could recognize that what they wanted to do was never going to sell to a publisher or direct to self-publishing. And some of them, you know, it's interesting as self-publishing has gotten better and more technological and streamlined. Sometimes you actually see a very nice product come from that. It's, you know, generally the arena of last resort, but you know, some people who have the ability can really make that work for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it used to be you had to pay a lot of money to self-publish to get something that was, you know, decent looking or of a professional quality. These days, when it comes to especially electronic publishing, you can get something that looks fabulous and pay $0. And it's really also removing some of the distribution barriers that used to be in place, where if you self-published, how could you possibly sell it or make people aware of it if it weren't on a major store shelf? But today, you know, those distribution challenges are melting, you know,
mm-hmm.
because you know, I could go to Amazon store today and upload a Word document that would be available for sale on the Kindle within about 30 minutes. I mean, that's how easy it is to get your work widely distributed.
Right. Anybody can have a book for sale on Amazon.
Yes.
It is amazing how different it is. Plus, the website, you know, if there's some writers listening, the way I always tell people to look at a website is the front page of every website, whether it's Joe Blow's, who's just written the story of his life in the Air Force in the 1950s, or Walmart, the front page is the front page of your website is the same size, no matter who you are or what company you are. And then
mm-hmm.
you have the ability to make it as deep and have as many shelves or rooms mm-hmm. or whatever you want to call it as Walmart does. It's just it's all left to your imagination, and that was really not an option, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, I often tell writers it's really not about money or power as much as it is about your time and energy and imagination, however much you have to put into it. You know, valuable stuff can get noticed and does get noticed in online settings. And a lot of agents and editors will, you know, keep their eyes open for people, for talented people who are online. And, you know, you hear these success stories. Of course, it's not an everyday thing, but of people who started a blog or did something very unique online and that parlayed into a book deal or something else.
Well, let's not undersell money and power. That's all.
Of course.
I know that being, you know, the omnipotent Mr. Media here. sorry. So before we wrap up, tell us a little bit about your blog and what people can find there.
Sure.
There are no rules.
Yes. I started this blog about a year and a half ago to address a lot of the issues that we've been talking about just now, about how the industry is changing, it's becoming very online-driven, and also looking at how there, even though there are more opportunities than ever for entrepreneurial-minded authors and writers, there are typically less opportunities going through traditional channels because the publishers are cutting back on their lists, publications are folding. So the blog was meant to address these challenges and what skills, you know, anyone would, you know, you need to really adapt to the environment and what skills do you need to make sure that you're going to be able to market yourself 5 years out or 10 years out. You know, being able to provide audio along with interviews, being able to do videos, having more technological savvy about what you're doing can go a long way.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, people could get by, you know, even just a few years ago, not being able to do any of these things, it's not going to be the case. So it's all of publishing is just becoming much more multimedia driven, and it's much more about, you know, being savvy about what is really good content and how it can be used, rather than saying, well, I just want to publish a book. I think a lot of people have become very book-focused. You know, they just want to get that physical book, but that's not where the process begins or ends. That's just, Seth Godin has said, you know, the book is now the souvenir of something much bigger about an author or an experience or the value that you're providing. So I try to get people to focus less on let me get my book published, then what do I stand for as an author, and who is my audience?
Hmm. Well, it's a very good blog. I actually checked it out after I first heard from you and went to it and found myself making some permanent bookmarks of several of the things that you sent people to. And I think I'm, at this point, a fairly experienced writer, but I'm still open to new information and new tips and stuff. So, you know, folks, if you haven't seen it, I encourage you to check that out. The address for Jane's blog is skip the www, it's blog.writersdigest, all solid, writersdigest.com/no-rules, R-U-L-E-S. And, of course, you can find Writer's Digest books and its flagship magazine at great bookstores everywhere, literally, or you can find them online at mrmedia.com, mrmedia.com, or Amazon.com, because much as they drive us crazy, they are the source of everything in the universe. Jane, it was wonderful to have you on the show. I'm really glad that you responded to the interview with Mike. I'm glad you didn't shoot any arrows in my heart. I need to stay healthy for the next interview. But really, seriously, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
All right. Take care of yourself.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And folks, for more interviews with your favorite journalists and authors, you can surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. That's where you can listen to my earlier conversations with A.J. Jacobs of Esquire, John Darden of the New York Times, 2009 Pulitzer Prize winner for features, Lane DeGregory, Mike Sachs, who I mentioned before and several times, who wrote And Here's the Kicker for Writer's Digest Books. And please think about writing an online review of Mr. Media, casting a vote for Mr. Media, or marking Mr. Media as one of your favorites. Whether you listen on Blog Talk Radio, TrueSlant, Digital Journal, Vox, Podcast Pickle, Mediafly, Blueberry, Zencast, Zimbio, or Odeo. And subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. Or subscribe to Mr. Media's blog on the Amazon Kindle Reader. There it goes again. It's everywhere. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. That's A-N-D-E-L-M-A-N. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/andelman. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate when you give up a piece of your day to spend it with us. Thanks for listening, everybody.